Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And today I am rejoined by Jenny Claridge.
Hello.
So today we are going to discuss the season one of The Jury. So we're going to start and break down that before we go into whether our jury system is indeed fit for purpose. So season one was where the male on female homicide, intimate partnership, newly married, only 2 months, weren't they? And we don't know the actual proper names of that case because I've not stumbled across that case that anything resembles it. I did have a Google, but I couldn't see anything that resembles it. So the names are, what were the names?
The lady was Helen. I can't remember what I was called there.
Was it John? Gary? Gary, yeah. So this relationship was very much, it was fast from the start. The progress was very fast from the start, wasn't it? So all the indicators that we look for, they were there in this case. Vulnerabilities were there. Yeah, bottom line is this marriage should never have taken place.
Mm-hmm.
Should it? But neither of them wanted to give in on the relationship. Both of them, even though it was toxic, they were told it was toxic, that the two, both of them just kept persevering with the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately it ended in fatality. But this one is because there was two juries on this one and they both came up with different verdicts. And the outcome should have been manslaughter. What was the actual outcome? Did they say?
Yeah, so
what was the actual outcome?
So the actual outcome was manslaughter. He received, I think it was 7.5 years or 6.5 years to serve 3. And then in the results of the experiment, one of the juries came up with murder.
Yeah.
Another jury has come up with manslaughter. I think me and you had kind of...
Yeah, I just missed it. I must have missed them mention the actual outcome. And obviously I knew there was the two different verdicts from the two different juries, because that was the only... They didn't do the same on season two with the two juries. They just did the one.
So ultimately, what had happened was there was a huge argument, and he has strangled her, and then he has walked off and he's got this big sort of like metal wielding hammer, and then come and smashed her skull in, essentially. And so his defense was loss of control. So he went in with the defense of loss of control.
Yeah.
So that was the kind of crux of the case.
Yeah. And I know, and although there's potential that there was a loss of, there's a loss of control in every single case of homicide. That goes without saying. Is it plausible that, She what th something she said, something she's done has triggered that response. Yeah. But what is debatable is where he has released once he's re once awareness has kicked in and he's released, realizing she's going blue, and then intentionally gone to go and get a hammer. And it's what he said to his to not his friend, his work part assistant, that what he was going to do as he went to go and get the hammer.
I don't know if he said that. What I do know is that after he killed her, he went back out and popped the hammer down on the side and said, "That's it, I've killed her."
Oh, was it the other way around? Was it, because I know he did say something. I thought he'd gone in to go and get the hammer, and then he, or did he come back and say that as, again? And I thought he came in to go and get the hammer from the workshop, and he said, "That's it. I'm done. I'm gonna kill her."
No, it was
Oh,
after he killed her. He went back and he put it down and
right,
said, "That's it, I've killed her."
right.
But I think,
So the question is why did he have one of those hammers in the house in the first place?
well, this is it. Well, this is the whole thing they were speaking about in the jury. He ordinarily keeps that in the sort of workshop area. So, there was quite a lot of suggestion that it was in the work area and was not in the house. So it wasn't a case of he strangled her and it was on the side and he's grabbed it and done it. He strangled her. He remembers seeing her turn blue. He remembers all that. And then he gets up, he releases her, he gets up, he walks off. So that would have taken a good few minutes for him to walk, go and get that hammer and then come back and smash her head in. Yeah, and I think the question was, was this murder or was this sort of like manslaughter on a base of like loss of control? I mean, how I feel about this case. Clearly people feel differently because I ultimately think that it should have been a murder charge and not a manslaughter charge.
Well,
And I've got my
it's more
reasons for that, obviously. We'll talk about that. So
based off if he had just if he'd killed her from the strangulation, there'd have been an argument for potentially manslaughter. But because that's not what killed her was the blows to the head. And it wasn't just one blow to the head, it was three blows to the head. So that is what killed her, and that was a second. And that's why we always have to consider what happened before the loss of control, and what happened after. And what happened after was an intentional act to intentionally go and get the hammer and intentionally hit her three times, and that is what killed her. So the intentional act is what killed her. So therefore, it would be murder.
Because it would have taken, loss of control is generally sort of like, it's like a split second thing, isn't it?
is, yeah.
Like that strangulation, you could absolutely see that as a loss of control. And like you said, like most of the time when there is a homicide, it is based on a moment of loss of control, isn't it?
I mean,
Certainly different
even when
things.
the, I mean, like, I know this is just, I'm just using this as an example in it, as just in another case, like Holly Newton's case. He intentionally, so he claimed loss of control as a result of having an autistic meltdown that led to a blackout. But that blackout isn't unique to people with autism. It applies to anybody, if certain things align. and triggers the periorbital grey. But what happened before was he intentionally seeked her out,
It was premeditated.
armed with a knife.
It was premeditated.
Exactly. So,
Absolutely.
even if his intention was to intimidate her with a weapon, there's a likelihood of killing. By that's why it's a crime to be in possession of a weapon anyway. So there was definitely a loss of control, even in that case. But what happened before was an intentional act. Whether it was to teach her a lesson, frighten her, intimidate her, or what, ultimately, that intentional act led to a loss of life.
But I mean, I suppose my point is with a lot of domestic abuse homicides, most people who have killed their partner can scream loss of control, because a lot of these things do happen in the house when there is an argument happening, and then they go ahead and they end up killing somebody in a loss of control. But does that mean they shouldn't be done for murder? Because
That's why the context is it matters, because if a victim who's been subjected to years and years and years of abuse, who snaps and loses control, well, there's still a loss of control from them and a loss of control from somebody who does an intentional act. Whether it's in the moment or an intentional act. So we have to look at the context around that loss of control. How did that loss of control become about? That's what we need to understand.
So, you know that my view on this case is very, very strong, because what I felt about this case when we were, trying to understand what that context was, okay, and the defense are putting across their side, and this is, to try and say this is why, he lost control. There was a lot of speak about her being abusive, okay, but that I feel really, really strongly about this one, and I was really upset both times that I watched this program. I was just sat there thinking, where is her voice? Like, where's her voice? Because we heard a lot from him and a lot from his defense and all his sort of people who the defense of Taylor picked out to be able to sort of like come across and go, she was manipulative, she was abusive, she was this, she was that. There was financial abuse, all mentioned, but there was actually no evidence of that, like no black and white evidence of that. And you didn't even hear from, the prosecution. I feel like
Was a
they.
little bit from a mum. A mum was a little bit from a mum, where a mum had said that she thought that he was good for her. He was good for her, and he was a calming influence on her, and that he was somebody that she could trust. And that's what a mum. It was only a little bit from a mum, and it was,
Very minimal. And
very, very
actually,
minimal.
at the end, in the end credits, there was an actual statement from the family and friends saying, we were really upset that we weren't invited to speak at this trial. Like, and I was just like, absolutely just like, where is this woman's voice? Because she is literally being painted out to be this lunatic woman, like, who was abusive, and I did not see like any black and white evidence of that. It was literally all just people talking about her and saying about what she was. And actually, yeah, she did come across as, and I say come across as because of the
Volatile.
one-sided evidence that we saw, that she did have some struggles and some issues, but there's all sorts of reasons for those, and we know that, but that also doesn't mean that she was, abusive or such. They said about, oh, there was financial abuse, but actually, where was the evidence of that? Because what I saw was this guy was so desperate to keep her. He was so clearly very in love with her, and he spent all his money on the wedding, right? But actually, where's the evidence that there was financial abuse that made him do that? Because I didn't see any.
I mean, she was. I mean, she was under. She was very reactive, which would be stemmed from the complex trauma that's gone
Allegedly,
off. Well, the psychologist did say that,
or that the defense picked.
but that's the one that's treated, isn't it? Didn't they treat her though from a teenager?
I think that they did see her, but I, we know, okay, we know from experience and from when we've seen other psychologists in the courtroom, like we did in season two. You can't always take on board what a psychologist, that psychologist, you just don't know how he kind of felt about her. And I
But
just couldn't take
people
that.
with complex trauma are naturally very are can be reactive.
Yeah, I
So
know
if
that. Yeah.
he's if her buttons are being pressed, and one thing that stood out for me was, which is something that he validated himself, what which allegedly was the root cause of why things exploded, that led to her losing her life, was And it's something that I can relate to, and I know you can because you were in a similar situation where she's moved into his house, and she's trying to make it her own. She's trying to make herself feel more at home and a sense of belonging, I suppose. Put her own stamp on, I suppose, is the best way to describe it. And it was something that he got irritated by. Now, I know that's something that I always felt like my ex didn't like me doing that. And I felt like I was intruding, like I felt like I was a lodger, even though we were married. And that can cause somebody, if somebody's making comments in regards to that, that can cause somebody to snap and react.
Absolutely, especially if it's
So,
been going on for a while, you know.
yeah. So if he's brought her into his home, which we know is what happened and how the relationship began, in one hand he'll be saying, "But of course I want you here." But on the other hand, he'll be saying, "But this is my home, and you're taking advantage. You're intruding. You shouldn't be moving my things. You shouldn't be putting this here, that here, and that there, because this is my home."
And for someone with complex trauma, you know, that can be really, really painful,
Yeah,
can't
absolutely, I
it?
can, and that's something that I experienced. I experienced that.
And so if she's sort of beginning to, you know, act in reactive ways when things like that are being said, you know, does that make her an abuser? Does that make her a perpetrator of domestic abuse? You know, does that make her a violent resister? So it's because of the way that she behaved in her trauma, it was very easy for the defense and for him and people around him to point her out to be this huge problem, which is why I had an issue that her voice wasn't heard and we weren't ever hearing her side of the story. And I am fuming with the prosecution for that.
Well, it goes back to the same thing again. You know, they're not, it's incomplete case files. You know, we're always seeing this incomplete case files. Well, how can you prove beyond reasonable doubt on an incomplete case file? You absolutely can't. There's just no excuse for it, to be honest with you. Not when you're dealing with something quite as serious as this. You know, and let you know, and let's say, you know, this is what leads to even people, you know, getting the book thrown at them, and actually, you know, they were acting in out of self-defense because of incomplete case files. So it happens in, you know, either way. If I've got an incomplete case file, it's too easy to get it wrong.
But also, you know, you see it all the time as well with prosecutions who think that they have a slam dunk case, you know. They think that they've got a slam dunk case, or there's no way that anybody's going to see this as anything else, and they just don't put the work in. You see it all the time. It just really, really upset me, that
It's never
case.
black and white, is it? You know, as we always say, you know, coercive control is not black and white, but neither is somebody's mental health, sadly. You know, how the brain operates, functions, and responds in certain situations is not black and white. You know, you've got two elements there that are not black and white. So, you know, it requires, you can't just have surface level investigation and sloppy, or let's just get the easy stuff. No, unfortunately, nothing about these cases are going to be easy for you. It is going to require effort, and you know, the police applying themselves on behalf of CPS.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But so we're just going to break for a short interval, and we shall see you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Up optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato. Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle Magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month. Let's all put health first.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, welcome back. So we're going to just discuss some of the comments that were made by some of the members of the jury. And one of the things that kind of stood out to me was, I mean, there was lots of things that stood out, but one of them said, he just looks like a normal person. And this is one thing that I always say is that, you know, there's no people who commit these crimes, they don't have a certain look, appearance, background. They just don't. I mean, goodness me. I mean, look at Joanna Simpson's, you know, killer. He was a British Airways pilot, for heaven's sake. You know, there is no... there's no type. And this is why you cannot, you have to leave your opinions at the door. And unfortunately, the ones that don't look the type are the ones where you have to work harder to...
This is the issue with, like, calling people monsters, isn't it? Oh, you know, they were a monster and stuff like that, because it puts this image in your head of these, you know, big, burly, rough looking sort of, oh my god, you know, you just look at them and you can tell that they're, you know, they're violent. It's like, it just, it is, doesn't work like that. And that's, you know, calling people monsters, it gives that impression, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. You know, it you know, and unfortunately, appearance and image can hide a thousand sins. You know, the more influential a perpetrator is, you know, in their career or social status, financial status, all of these hide so much. And you have to, and those are the things that actually people form first impressions of you with. So you have to look beyond that and not look at, well, oh, they don't seem the type, because, you know, anybody can behave in that way. You know, these are unhealthy coping mechanisms that are developed from a young child. And the more they've gone unaddressed, the more, the stronger the entitlement becomes. So, you know, there is no type. So that was something that really stood out for me.
Yeah, I mean, this guy in this, you know, in this case in season one, you think about the, you know, when the defense brought forward all of these character references, and you know, there was a stream of these character references, and I just sort of like looked at that and I thought, well, do you know what? Like, if I was in that position, or I was the, you know, the person who had been murdered, and it was my ex that had done that, He absolutely, no doubt about it, would have been able to get like character reference after character reference after character reference, because he was so communal and obviously would do anything for anybody apart from me. Obviously.
Mine was the same.
And they could so easily get these characters. And again, this is where you should absolutely never judge a book by its cover or what you see on the outside, because you just never know what's going along like
In
underneath
fact,
that.
I know with mine, mine used to refer. He used to talk to, when he'd refer to me to other people, was not how he would talk to me and engage with me directly, behind closed doors. And I remember something one of our neighbors said to me, actually, do you know, when he talks about you and your relationship and your future together, it sounds like a fairy tale. They were her precise words, a fairy tale. And I said, but the thing is, fairy tales aren't real, are they?
I mean, I had like sort of similar, but not the same. Like, we lived next door to a psychiatrist, who he was very, very good friends with. He was friends with, or very friendly with, all the neighbors. And he used to talk to the psychiatrist about me and my mental health and how worried he was about my mental health. And he would tell him all these stories about how nuts and crazy I was, but about how much he cared about me and how
In
much
an empathetic
help.
way, yeah.
Yeah, and
A
he would, that's what he
supportive and
would do.
helpful way, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what you would do with all. So all of the neighbors thought I was a right crazy bitch, and that's. But they all thought that he really, really cared about me, and it was because he was worried about me, So yeah.
So, he didn't look the type. He's not, we need to, look beyond image. Yeah. And I
Yeah.
mean that, I know in the the an Amber, what's her surname? Amber.
If you want about Johnny Depp and Amber
Yeah,
Heard.
sorry, Johnny Depp and Amber. What's the surname? Amber
Heard. Heard.
Heard. Again, that was image. That was that influenced everybody there.
Yeah, there was a lot of image management going on there. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because once you form an opinion of somebody, it's very hard to look beyond that opinion. That's the problem, and that's why you always have to leave your opinions at the door.
And you see this very clearly in this state case as well, because A, they thought he looked like a normal, soft, gentle guy, but because of everything that was being said about her, about the fact that she had three children by three different guys, and that she had complex trauma and things like that, they were like labeling her already at very early stages that she was a nightmare. And she was, a nutty, and she couldn't even keep her legs closed and things like that. And that was very early on. They were all judging her and the way that she was, but they were judging him, but in a different way. The misogyny in that room was rife, like.
I mean, there was one person on the jury as well, and this is the problem, is people are bringing in their own personal experiences and allowing that to shape their verdict. And I think it was Gary who was, he admitted to perpetrator behavior towards his wife.
He was laughing. He was saying, "Oh, I've chucked cups of coffee at her and plates and everything," and he was laughing.
And although he was later interviewed with his wife, which obviously gave her that voice, and we heard the full context of what happened, which was great, but that's not how he didn't give that full context from what we heard whilst he was in dialogue with the other members of the jury. He was just, oh yeah, I've thrown cups of coffee at her and I've done this and I've done that.
A lot of people were
And
laughing at that sort of thing. There was a couple who were like mortified, but a lot of them actually found it quite funny. Whether that was because they were nervous, I don't know, but oh.
I found, the way he said it was normalizing that behavior. It was like, well, that's just normal behavior. It's not an unusual way to behave in a relationship. And
Absolutely.
that's what I found the most dangerous, irregardless of whether he did show empathy and remorse when he was sat with his wife and they were being interviewed then, externally from the jury process. But in the jury room, it was he was normalizing that behavior, and I suppose, making it sound
No.
grandiose. It like you know super you know it's like a big thing to do. It's like a big man thing to do. That's how it came across to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just came across to me that he just, like you said, normalized it. Like it's normal for a couple to have an argument and for your other half to throw a hot cup of coffee at you, because that's exactly what he did to her. But actually, she actually ended up running him over, didn't
She
she?
did,
He
yeah.
actually ended up
But it goes
running
back to
over.
that. If you push, eventually, that somebody's even the most calmest person in the world will snap eventually.
This
It may not
again.
result in what in I mean, in that action, but it could result in scream. I mean, I know with me, it was I when my ex used to constantly poke prod, poke prod, poke prod, poke prod. I would get to the point where if he got me to a place where I was not only criticized, ridiculed, humiliated, blamed for things I hadn't done, and induced immense fear, I would scream uncontrollably, scream hysterically, cry. I mean, that would combined with crying, screaming, and I was literally like out of control. And then he would switch to, "Look, it's all right, love. Just calm yourself down. You just need to calm yourself down." Well, I don't want it. You're the one that's tripped, put me in this state. Now you're saying calm down.
I was in that state once, and I was picked up off the floor by him, sat on the toilet seat, and told that I would be put in a mental home if I didn't stop. But yeah, no, I totally get it. But like, in their case, the jury, that guy from the jury, that was like years. She was, enduring years and years of abuse. It's the same as like Sally Challen's. She, years and years and years of abuse in Sally Challen's case. Richard Challen, it had sort of like, he'd anally raped her as punishment for things, so you can certainly see, how Sally snapped the way she did, like when there was perhaps something that wasn't as big. But in the, in this case, these two, they weren't together for overly long, were they? But the guy from the jewelry and his wife together a long time, still together now. And it did look like he, perhaps may have been taking some
And
treatment
that what
at
his
work.
wife did is very similar to what Sally did. It was more of a, as opposed to snapping, it wasn't a snapping in the moment. It was more of a acting on trauma logic, because thinking this is the only logical way out of my nightmare. Or, I'm going to teach you, do to you what you do to me. It's acting on trauma logic. It's still from the same place as snapping. That's still the same part of the brain that's running, operating the show. But it's slightly different to snapping and reacting in the moment.
Well, I don't know, because I think for me it did sound like she snapped. Sounded to me like she just snapped, and she
I
was
think the
like,
way she described it, though, it was, you know what, I'm going to teach you a lesson. I think that's the way it came across to me. And in some ways, like with Sally, she did, she intentionally went seeking him with the hammer and to do what she did. But she was acting, like she says, that always seemed the only logical way out of the nightmare that I was trapped in. It seemed, in fact, I think her precise words were, it was my only logical way to gain any peace. So she's acted on trauma logic, because actually, when she did it, it didn't result in any peace. Because that's why she went to go and end her own life. Because it didn't give her that peace that she was that she thought that that trauma logic thought was going to be gained. You don't think rationally, do you, when you're in that state of mind? And these are all the things that need to be taken into consideration when we are evaluating any case. Is, even things that what the evidence suggests that it's premeditated, we've got to look at the what's led somebody to that place, and were they thinking logically and rationally? because, like in Sally's case, she wasn't thinking logically or rationally at all. You know, it's no different to, you know, the amount of women that we see going out, and it is mainly women that do this, is going out on social media and naming the perpetrator, putting a video footage out, audios out, and everything else, pictures. And I get it, I get it. But unfortunately, you're not doing yourself any favors. You are responding from trauma logic. Trauma logic, that makes sense, that those doing that, it totally makes sense. But from a practical and realistic perspective, actually, all you're going to do is put yourself in more danger. But the brain isn't thinking like that, unfortunately.
No. Yeah, but like ultimately in this case, you know, they had made their minds up very early about her and what she was like, and made their minds up about, you know, what sort of guy he was. And bearing in mind, this is all based on like a one-sided view of this relationship, because like I said before, you know, her voice was never heard in this. She was a footnote in her own, you know, murder, as Laura Richards would say, footnote in her own murder. She was invisible. She was invisible in this case. And other than being this crazy woman who essentially deserved what she got, because the comments that people were making, you know, there was one, you know, what did she do? What did she do to sort of like trigger him? What did she say to him? What did she do to him? And there was another one like, well, maybe the house was a tip and she never lifted a finger and he got fed up with it, as if
Yeah.
like
And that's
that
not
is a good enough
justification. It's
reason
not
for
justification.
exactly, like, you know, so she deserves to die. Does she, even if she was a complete slob and didn't do anything, and you know, does that mean that she deserves to die? Because some of these comments, that's what it came across like.
And if she was, given the fact that we know that she had complex trauma stemming back from childhood. We know that is a symptom of complex trauma. You know, I am very, very disorganized in terms of, I mean, I've always got clean clothes on the spare bed, Jen. And they will stay there until I get so frustrated that I can't find something. But that is a symptom of, or if I've got somebody coming round and I'm worried about somebody thinking I'm a slob. That's when I will sort it out. So, you know, you don't, you know, if that is the case, that was a symptom of her trauma.
Yeah, but I
That
mean,
didn't make her a bad person.
there wasn't any evidence that's what she was like. That was just some of the comments that were being made, or maybe she was like this, or maybe she was like that, and like just, you know, comments that were essentially saying maybe she deserved to be killed, you know. And that is what infuriated me and upset me so much. And you know, like I said, just the misogyny that was in that room was just unbelievable. And that's an issue when it comes to sit, you know, people sitting on the jewelry, and the outcome, and ultimately resulting, you know, that's going to be a big factor in the result of that case.
It is.
And I think, you know, what was said about her, bearing in mind, you know, even the guy who was up in, you know, on trial would say that she had been in abusive relationships in the past. He was saying that himself, and then they had an ex-partner on there saying what a nightmare she was. Well, actually, if you're saying that she had been in an abusive relationship, how do you know that he wasn't an abuser and he's not just saying these things about her because he's a perpetrator? There was like no clear evidence as to what was going on in this case, but she was essentially blamed for her own murder. And because she had complex trauma, it was easy for them to blame her for that.
We're just going to break for another interval, and we shall see you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena-sensitive care pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena-sensitive care pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So before we wrap up, we're just going to give our views and opinions on what the verdict should have been. And I think we've kind of a little bit touched on it already. But based off the, we always have to prove beyond reasonable doubt. Everything has to be beyond reasonable doubt. And, you know, what we know is that what killed her was the blow to the head with the hammer that he intentionally went to go and get after he had released his grip from around her neck, noticing that she'd gone blue. So if we're talking about beyond reasonable doubt and there being an intention to kill, well, we know there was an intention to kill in that moment. So so therefore it would be murder. If he'd stopped at that, had strangulated around the, if it was the neck that had strangulation that had killed her, I think it would have been manslaughter, because I don't think there's beyond reasonable doubt either way. I don't think we could prove either way whether he intended to put, you know, have his hand around the throat, or whether what his analogy did actually take place. Mm. We can't prove either way because the evidence isn't there, like you said.
I mean, from my opinion on it is that because there was a little bit of sort of in what was said, a little bit of verbal evidence that he perhaps was triggering her. It was made a comment made by one of the jurors, you know, perhaps he had that actually done more to trigger her that day than the other way around. You know, and potentially, you know, this argument broke out, and that, you know, I think she was gonna leave him, and he didn't want that. He'd spent all his money and all this, that, and the other. And, you know, he lost control and he put his hands around her neck and strangled her. He said that he remembered her turning blue. You know, potentially with the evidence that was seen in that case, bearing in mind we didn't have her voice. Based, so if you're going to be believing everything that was said by the defense, you know, maybe manslaughter because you know he's lost control in that moment and put his hands around her neck and strangled her. But my view is, I'm sitting in the camp of that should have been absolutely should have been a murder charge, because he did that. He let go of her neck and he walked off. You know, which is going to take a couple of minutes. He even made a comment that he didn't want her to survive or something along those lines to his colleague. And then he's picked up the hammer from the workshop. He's come back and he's smashed around the head 3 times with a hammer meant to use, you know, be used for metal. Bearing in mind, he knows how to use that hammer. There was clear intention to kill her there. And I don't see... The the events, the way that it led up to what happened, as a loss of control. Maybe in the moment when he strangled her, that was a loss of control, but the fact that he got up and he went and got that hammer and he came back, I think he was just fuming. I think he was fuming. I think he wanted her dead. I think he was absolutely crapping himself because she was going to leave him. They were married. He had already lost loads of money, like, because he'd spent all this money on her. And I think he was crapping himself as to what was going to happen. And I think he was really angry. And I think he wanted her dead in that moment. And I don't see that. I see that as murder. That is where I'm sitting with that.
I mean, another thing, one of the members of the jury did say that was, obviously she lost her life as a result. She was vulnerable. She was vulnerable because of her childhood experiences. And, it goes back to, one thing I try to obviously, like when I was at the social work event, obviously not only recently. And one thing we need to always do is how can we prevent fatalities like this happening? And when we know a child has had adverse experiences, there is a risk of them either becoming the perpetrator or becoming the victim. So, from a preventability perspective, if she had been given the right help and support from a early age, she might still be alive today, because her attachment style would have potentially developed very differently. So there's so many things there that we need to start, and we need to start and really think about long term. What road are we is a person heading down? I mean, I know for me, with what I experienced as a child, it was inevitable I was going to end up in a relationship like I did. It was inevitable.
Yeah, same for me, really. Same for
And
me.
if somebody had stepped in and things might and my life had taken a different course, can I say with conviction that I wouldn't have? No, of course I can't. But the chances of it happening would have been significantly less. And I certainly would have potentially had handled a lot of the behaviours. I would have walked away a lot sooner, potentially. Because a lot of the behaviors wouldn't have been normalized in my life. So there's lots of lessons here, and that's what I always like professionals to do is learn from lessons. What can we learn? And what we can learn here is all of this was preventable. Same as the case that we covered on season two, it was all preventable. If people had stepped in sooner. There was multiple opportunities to intervene. Multiple. And that's the heartbreaking thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Any final thoughts, Jen, before we sign off?
Yeah, I mean, final thoughts around season one, as I said at the very beginning, it was very upsetting for me. I feel and it's the same with a lot of women who are murdered in these kinds of situations. They become invisible. I feel like she was completely invisible in this trial, which was really upsetting. I would have liked to have heard her voice. It just happens all the time. The misogyny, I think, a lot of this, his result of manslaughter at the end of the day, I feel comes down to misogyny. You've seen it very clearly in that courtroom. You've seen it in season two as well.
And I think the final thing is that the emphasis on robust case files, complete case files, and ultimately that's the responsibility of CPS and the police. They have to do better. There's no
And
excuses.
the prosecution needed to do better in this case as well. I believe. And you see that in
There's no
every.
excuses for incomplete case files because, you put so much emphasis on proven beyond reasonable doubt. Well, when you've got an incomplete case file, you've failed miserably at that task,
And like what
in
you've
my
said
opinion.
before as well, Kate, is when the police and the CPS do perhaps do a really lot of work to put this case together, and then they hand it over to any old schmo from the street who doesn't even understand, and they're left to make the decision, and that's all based on their own biases and lived experiences, and how they feel about and judge the potential, the people they are.
That's if they do their job properly, but it makes it even worse if they don't do their job properly on the front end and then pass it across to what I can only describe it as kangaroo court. That's the only logical thing that I can describe it as, because it is.
I certainly
It's
wouldn't want to be tried by a jury, I
I
can
wouldn't no I wouldn't either.
tell.
No, but we're going to do a completely separate episode on that. So, thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me again.
And we'll see you on the next episode.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls, and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specializing in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.